but newspress.com.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of Money Talk. I'm Neil Kreisel and Diane Duvernay, your hosts every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 11, and on Saturdays at 6. We're brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending, whose highly trained and experienced team takes great pride in helping people with home financing, offering competitive rates and a wide array of loan programs. Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1937, located on the corner of Olive and Cota Street in downtown Santa Barbara. And Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm in Santa Barbara, providing its clients with the personal care and attention of a small independent firm, coupled with the vast resources of a major financial institution.
Hi, Neil. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good, Diane. How are you doing?
Great. Had a great Mother's Day weekend.
Mother's Day is over?
No, for your wife, it should never be over.
That's what I mean. I'm supposed to make dinner tonight. I thought Mother's Day continues through Monday.
I like to celebrate all holidays for the month, so that's fine by me.
So, by any chance, do we have a guest today?
We do. We're lucky to have John Warrilow on the line with us. And we will be. He's been an entrepreneur and author for over 20 years, and he is involved in 20 years of research experience into the small and medium business markets. And he talks about business valuations. So I'm excited to hear what he has to say. John, thanks so much for being here with us.
Hey, thanks for having me. Good to be there.
So the first article we have today, from the Wall Street Journal, is entitled "Dollar's Dominance Creates Ripples Globally," and the dollar has become has gone up in value in the last 3 months. And one of the consequences is that it's wreaking havoc on countries like Argentina, Turkey, Indonesia, and there's several reasons for this. One is that most countries borrow in dollars. And so when you borrow money in dollars and you are denominated in your own currency, it costs more to repay the loan than when you took it out. And the other thing is when you trade, most trade in the world is still denominated in dollars. So if you're buying oil or you're buying raw materials for business in a foreign country, you're using your currency to buy a commodity that's priced in dollars, and it costs more. So there's a disruption taking place. As a dollar goes up in value, countries, particularly those countries that are connected to the American economy because of dollars, they're really getting hurt. And so the irony of this is we don't trade very much with Argentina, with Argentina, but it is being affected because of this phenomenon. So you just can't, when you look at the dollar's effect on a country, you just can't look at how much trade we do. We have to look at the effects that the dollar has. And the other interesting aspect is that in order to trade, and this is really kind of very subtle but interesting, in order to trade in the world's economy, a country needs dollars in order to buy things. And so many countries inventory dollars in order to make sure that they have enough dollars to pay for things that they'll need. And so, again, that puts them in a position where they're even more exposed than they would otherwise be.
You know, it's interesting because the economic forecasts that happened locally last week really focused a lot on trade and what the ramifications of different trade policies that the U.S. may have. And so if you listen to last week's show, you heard Professor Rupert talking about that. And I would encourage you to go to the economic forecasts website and check out what his speakers had to say about global trade.
And one of the things that is taking place is the whole issue about inflation has consequences to the world's economy, because if the Fed believes that inflation is picking up, they're going to raise rates. And if you raise rates in a country, you create a rise in that country's currency, because there is an attraction to get a higher yield in that currency. So the dollar's strength is not over if, in fact, there is the possibility of further increases by the Fed. Second article we have is entitled "Record Buybacks Help Steady Wobbly Stock Market." And the article discusses a phenomenon that's been taking place since the tax reform back in January. And this, you know, by the way, has this whole political aspect, because the hope was that the hope from the administration and the supply side was that when you reduce corporate taxes, the result will be corporations investing more in their business, creating more jobs, and that in turn would create more profits, and therefore the tax reductions would pay for themselves. But what's happening so far is that most of the companies in the S&P 500 are using this newfound cash to buy back their own stock. And this buyback is so substantial that many observers believe that it is the one factor, because the retail investor is getting out, is the one factor that's causing the stock market to go up.
And well, when you think about that, it was a 16% reduction in corporate taxes. So that's a sizable chunk of change that these companies, corporate America, is saving by not paying the taxes. So they have a lot of cash on hand to participate in corporate buyback.
And there's a double-edged phenomenon, because when you buy your stock back with cash, it's an anti-dilutive measure. You're actually increasing earnings per share, because you're taking cash, which is not dilutive, and you're reducing the number of shares. Given income being the same, your earnings per share goes up. So it's a double whammy. You're buying the stock, and you're increasing your earnings per share. Of course, the downside of this is that if companies are using money to either increase their dividend or back buy their shares, it may have a short-term effect on the stock market, but it's not doing what the supply-siders said it would do, which is to cause increased investments by corporations, which will result in more jobs and higher wages.
Yeah, it's interesting. They're not buying more capital equipment. They're really, the corporate America is not participating in it, in this tax cut like the administration was hoping.
Well, not to crow, but no surprise here, because interest rates have been so low, any company that needed more plant and equipment would have borrowed the money at 2 or 3%. And so the whole notion that companies were waiting for a tax break in order to invest in plant and equipment, in my view, was nonsense. And right now, there is no more options that were waiting for more cash. The one thing companies didn't need in the last 3-4 years to invest was money. It was very easy to come by. So to me, this is no surprise. The final article we have is, I think, you know, kind of weird. It's called "Choosing the Right Vehicle," and we'll get to what the word "vehicle" means for your cash. And it was in the Wall Street Journal this weekend, and it announces that, or not announces, but tells us that Mercedes-Benz is offering a direct mail to its automobile owners, where you can lend Mercedes cash that you would otherwise put in a money market fund and get a 2.5% return, which is higher than less than 1% you would get in a money market account. And Mercedes is a great company, but what you're doing is you're lending money to Mercedes Credit Corp. It's not guaranteed by any government agency. There's no market, public market for the securities. And so if there were to be a problem, it would not be the same by any measure as investing in treasury bills or in a government guaranteed CD. Furthermore, the interest rate is variable, and Mercedes-Benz Financial weekly sets that rate. So if interest rates were to change, that rate would change as well. But the funny part about this article is at the very end, it says that the majority of automobiles that Mercedes sells in the U.S. About half were financed by Mercedes-Benz Financial Services at a rate of over 4% borrowing cost. So what the article suggests is rather than lend money to Mercedes, you're better off paying cash for your car and not go through because there's a negative spread. Anyway, the fact that people are doing this is sort of surprising, but this goes along with a whole trend of people chasing yield.
Right. It's been low interest rate environment for a long time now. People are looking for more.
You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
For prospective homebuyers, one of the most important steps of the loan process is getting clear and honest information from someone who will speak plainly and truthfully about loan programs and options.
I'm Kelly Marsh, Vice President, California, of Cornerstone Home Lending, where our highly skilled and experienced team takes great pride in helping clients obtain home financing with honest, knowledgeable, fast, friendly, and efficient service. As a Santa Barbara native who has spent the past 20 years in the mortgage industry and has closed over 4,000 loans, I'd appreciate the opportunity to earn your business and invite you to visit thekellymarshteam.com or call my office at 805-563-1100 to learn more about how Cornerstone Home Lending can help you determine the best way to manage mortgage debt to achieve a more stable financial future.
Licensed by the Department of Business Oversight under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. California Residential Mortgage Lending Act license number 41DB072220. California Financial Lending Law license number 60DB072528. Loan originator NMLS number 245822. Not a commitment to loan. Equal housing opportunity.
It's a fact. Successful wealth management is built on strategies that focus on the big picture, take a long-term view, and establish deep and valued relationships. Hello, I'm Diane Duva, founding partner at Arlington Financial Advisors, Santa Barbara's trusted family guide, empowering you to make more informed and confident decisions. At Arlington Financial Advisors, we bring order and balance to your financial life by monitoring and managing risk so you can focus on your work, family, and enjoying the moment. We are a fully independent firm offering strategic financial planning, estate and tax planning, and private money management. Our plans and portfolios are handcrafted using a rigorous and disciplined approach, supported by a consistent yet highly personalized client experience. Our clients look to Arlington Financial Advisors as a home away from home, a comfortable place to protect what they've accomplished while they prepare for what comes next. Please visit ArlingtonFinancialAdvisors.com or call me, Diane Duva, at 805-699-7300.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending. Since 1988, a mortgage banker and direct lender that believes in providing in-depth loan consulting to its customers in a personalized and honest manner. And we can be reached at 564-1290.
Or at moneytalk1290@gmail.com. If you have a question for us or our guest, John Warolo, who's an entrepreneur who founded the Value Building System to help level the playing field for business owners as they approach their exit. So, John, thanks so much for being here with us. Tell us, how did you get involved in starting your own business?
Ask a question again.
Hey, Diane.
Hi, thanks so much for being with us. So tell us, how did you get involved in starting your own business?
Oh, man, I was working in a radio station, of all things. I was
laughing funny. When I was hearing your, full circle.
Yeah, I was laughing when I was hearing your intro and how quickly the voice has to kind of do the T's and C's of all the commercials. The guy speeds up to like 500 words a second. I used to work in radio, and I had this idea for a radio show. I thought it'd be kind of cool to interview different entrepreneurs to find out how they kind of built their companies.
And that's our show.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I pitched it to the program director at the time, and he's like, would never work, would never fly. And I guess I wanted to prove him wrong. So I put the show together. I got a big sponsor, a big bank up in Canada. And we put it together. Ultimately, it became a nationally syndicated show, and Canada ran every day for 3 years. And that's 25 years ago now. That was sort of the first foray into entrepreneurship, but also sort of studying entrepreneurs and sort of how they think, how they act, because I got to interview so many of them.
Interesting. So now tell us a little bit about the Value Builder System. What does that mean?
Well, what really, is that? It's, yeah, we work with entrepreneurs to help them improve the value of their company, oftentimes leading up to their exit. You know, when I talk to business owners, and it may be the same there in Santa Barbara, what I hear is that, you know, most of them are starting to think about exiting. Maybe they've got it sort of in the next 5 to 10 years on their radar, but they've never gone through the process of selling, right? So they've kind of got a bit of a question mark around what that process is like, what do they need to do to prepare, and we just help them do that. We get them ready to go to market, and oftentimes sort of help them get a premium for their business, help them kind of point out some things they can do to make their business more valuable than it would be if they don't do those things. So that's what we do.
Isn't part of that, though, a psychological job? I mean, if you have more than one family member, I guess part of the work you do is family counseling.
Well, not really, actually, because right now the majority of business owners don't have any interest in passing their business on to their kids. You know, that's a bit of a fallacy. When we talk to entrepreneurs, it's only about 14% who plan to pass their business on to their kids. And I think we've all heard horror stories about families breaking up because of terrible transitions. So most of the business owners that you talk to, if you just surveyed a group of business owners in Santa Barbara, it would be a small percentage of them that plan to pass their business to their kids, about 14%.
I so bet the kids, the percentage is a little different of thinking that they're getting the business passed to them.
Maybe. Although I think it's a really bad decision on many, many fronts to pass your business down to your kids. But that's probably a different story. You know, the majority of the business owners we talk to plan to sell their company. About 60% plan to sell their business to the next to the next owner, which is not a family member. And so, you know, family transitions. You know, 50 years ago, when you think about it, it was like, John Smith and Sons, Bob's Plumbing and Sons. It was always the first son would get the business. Nowadays, it doesn't. That's virtually gone by the wayside. But first of all, the sons and the daughters don't want the company. They don't want to put in the sweat equity that their parents did. And second of all, most of them are not really prepared. You know, a lot of second generation people are. You know, they've gone to good schools, they've gone to Stanford, or but they're just not entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs are a different breed altogether. They pull themselves up by the bootstraps. They tilt at windmills. They're not the second generation type people who are inheriting businesses. So again, it's just not something we see a lot of, and nor do I think we should see a lot of, frankly.
So you talk about leveling the playing field for business owners. What do you mean by that?
So right now, when business owners go to exit their company, they are bringing a knife to a gunfight. So on the other side of the negotiation table, when you go to sell your company, you're going to have, if you've got a decent-sized business, a private equity group. Now, a partnered private equity group went to Stanford, Wharton, Harvard, and they went to the finest schools and they learned how to manipulate financial statements to their benefit. And so they will prey on your naivete, your ignorance about what drives company value. They will prey on it to the extent that they will take your business using schemes and tricks for much less than it's worth. And so you've got a situation where business owners have worked their entire life to build a company worth something, and they are being taken to the cleaners by these financial engineers, these mercenaries, who are using things like vendor takebacks, they're using things like earnouts, escrows that are out of market, all sorts of, you know, personal guarantees that are ludicrous terms for a professional investor. But again, as business owners, we don't think about these things, right? We're busy serving customers, we're busy building companies, driving the economy. But when it comes to sell, we are outgunned beyond any measure. And so what we try to do is fix that. We try to give business owners the insight, the information, the education, so that at least they can have a fighting chance to sell their business for a fair value.
So now you talk about having 8 drivers. So what are the 8 drivers that you use to help these business owners, or to help drive business value, I should say?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, recurring revenue. So one of the 8 drivers is how much recurring revenue you've got coming into your company. You know, when a buyer buys your business, they know that when they write you the fat check that's got 6 zeros on it or 7 zeros on it, you're gone. You're on the beach, you're on the golf course, you're mentally not there anymore, right? They know that. And so they're willing to write a bigger check to you as the owner if they can see that you've got some recurring revenue. And so recurring revenue is revenue that kind of comes in without the customer having to make the decision to buy. So in wealth management, for example, you know, you basically get a fee to manage the wealth, and that happens forever until they say stop managing the wealth. In a software company, they've got SaaS revenue, software as a service revenue. That's the kind of revenue buyers want to see. The kind of revenue they don't want to see is one-off revenue. So I'll give you an example. If you take security businesses these days, you know, the guys who wire up your home or your office, they've got two forms of revenue. They've got the installation revenue. They charge you to come and put the system into your home or your office, wire up all the keypads and the sensors. That revenue is not very attractive to buyers. And so a buyer today will pay about 75 cents for every dollar on that revenue. What most buyers want buying security companies these days is the recurring revenue. So they'll actually pay $2 for every dollar of monitoring revenue that you've got as a security company. That's the recurring revenue that you have as a security business. And so it's almost three times more value on a dollar per dollar basis to have revenue that recurs than to have one-off revenue. So that's one of the eight drivers. It's a big deal to be able to demonstrate that you've got recurring revenue.
Absolutely. And so in today's day and age where, you know, there's been a lot of emphasis placed on growing large social media audiences or followings for specific companies, how much value is placed on that, those eyeballs, if you will, in terms of valuing a company?
Well, a buyer's going to look at your platform, and your platform could include your social media platform, so Twitter followers, Instagram, you know, Facebook, et cetera. It could include that. It could also be sort of more old school, especially if you're targeting a slightly older audience. It could be just simple plain Jane email opt-in. But they're going to look at your platform and try to ascertain that. I'll give you an example. I'm aware of a situation. I won't say the name of the company because it's private information, but it's an app on the App Store, Apple App Store. They've got more than 10,000 Facebook fans. That was a consideration in the acquirer that just made an offer to buy that app, the fact that they have a platform. So it can be important. It's one of the many factors that go into the value of a business. I wouldn't, however, build up a social media following because you think that's going to be what customer or buyers really care about. It's a relatively minor factor in what customers care, in what acquirers care about. You know, important factor would be plain profitability. So clearly, the acquirers are going to want to know how profitable your business is going to be in the future. That's going to be much more important to them, other than in rare circumstances, than how many Facebook fans you have or how many LinkedIn connections you've got, for example.
You're listening to Money Talk on the Santa Barbara News Press radio station, and we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Diane Duva with an invitation for you to enjoy a great dining experience at my favorite restaurant, the world-famous Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1940. It's located on the corner of Olive and Coda Streets in downtown Santa Barbara. Arnaldi's specializes in traditional home-style Italian food prepared with the freshest produce, finest quality meats and fish, and the very best imported Italian meats, cheeses, and olive oil, along with local fish and specials from our Santa Barbara Farmers Market, and an extensive wine list served in the unique atmosphere of a candlelit dining room. Arnaldi's also caters to weddings and rehearsal dinners, receptions, graduations, birthdays, holiday parties, or any special event, with two large dining rooms, a huge heated patio, fire pit, two bocce ball courts, and a stone barbecue with red oak wood. And Arnaldi's is happy to work with you to create a custom menu and handle any special requests. Visit arnaldis.com or call 805-962-5394.
Are you ready to start and run your own successful business? Ready to grow your small business or home business? Women's Economic Ventures is a local nonprofit helping women start and build successful businesses. In addition to their highly successful self-employment training program, Weave offers services to help women succeed at every stage of their business, from startup and launch to building and sustaining a business, including individual business counseling, professional networking events, advanced business training, and small business loans to start or expand a business. Over 1,000 local businesses are now owned and operated by women who have taken part in programs and services. Whether you're ready to start up, launch, build, or sustain your business, Women's Economic Ventures is right here to help you make it happen. Call 965-6073 or visit weaveonline.org.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence. John, let me ask you a question. You are, I guess, forced in your business to deal with a vast array of businesses. So are you always learning someone's business, or is the ability to understand the buyer's point of view more important, and it doesn't really matter what the sellers specifically do? Like, how do you deal with varied sellers of every type?
Like, how does a SaaS business differ from a retail shop?
Oh, right. Yeah. I mean, industry has a major impact on the company value. What we see is that obviously technology companies will get, generally better multiples than a service business, as an example. A manufacturing company will generally get a better valuation than personal service businesses. So we do see these variances by industry. However, one of the biggest mistakes we see company owners make is assuming that they're going to get the same value as a company in a similar industry to theirs, and sort of forgetting about all the other factors. So a common example would be like, I'm a plumber. I've got $1 million business, $1 million revenue company. My friend I met at a plumbing convention said that plumbing companies trade for 1x revenue. Therefore, I'm predetermined to get 1x revenue. We've seen examples in our work where companies will get half as much as the industry, rule of thumb, because they've fallen down on the 8 key drivers of company value. Or we've seen examples where companies will get 2 or 3 times more than the industry rule of thumb because they're outperforming on some of these drivers. So while industry does play a role, what we see is that it's a little bit overused as a valuation technique. And we've seen companies do much better or much worse than the industry, kind of rule of thumb.
So for business owners who are thinking about selling, what are some of the things that they can do to prepare?
Right. So we talked about recurring revenue, out of the gate. One of the other things that they can do is make sure their company is not dependent on them personally. Easy for me to say, really tough to do. The idea, we call it hub and spoke management. The idea that decisions have to come through you as the owner, whether that's, approving a customer discount or maybe taking on a new supplier line or new pricing offering. If those decisions are coming through you, you're setting yourself up as a hub and spoke manager. And a buyer looking to buy your business is going to realize that when they write you a check, you're gone. And so that's going to be a problem. And so really what you want to do is set your company up so that it can survive and indeed thrive without you. One of my favorite tactics around that is to take a vacation. I mean, you live in a beautiful part of the world there in Santa Barbara. Just go to the beach for a couple of days. Really totally check out of your business. Leave the mobile phone at home and really check out and see what falls down, see what breaks down, and try to go back to the office or the shop floor and fill in those gaps by training people to do what broke down when you were gone, hiring someone to do it, because that's the acid test as to whether you've got a sellable company is how well it performs when you're personally not there. If sales flatline or, operations take a turn for the worse, you don't have a sellable company. You've got really a glorified job, and it's your job as the owner to make those changes so that you do have something you could sell.
Do you represent companies in the sale, or do you do consulting to have them be able to do it themselves? What's your business model?
Yeah, so our business model is we license our platform to advisors. And so we realized early that advisors, so financial advisors, business brokers, accountants, M&A professionals, they're the ones that have the relationship with the business owners. So we license our platform to 920 different advisors. We call them certified value builders around the world. And they're the ones who do the consulting and coaching with their clients. And our system is their sort of back-end system. We're the kind of intel inside, if you will, if you use that technology example. We're the intel inside for financial advisors and wealth planners and business brokers and accountants who use it with their clients.
So when they print out something for their client, it doesn't show your name. It shows their name on the document.
Exactly. It's all a software program, so it's usually not printed, although you can print it. But yes, their logo would appear. It appears for intensive purposes as it's an offering coming from that coaching or consulting firm.
So you've set your business up to sell. When are you going to sell? I'm joking.
Exactly. No, more importantly, how do you know you're ready to sell, John?
So how do you know you're ready to sell? It's a great question. I mean, part of it comes down to, like, you've got something you want to go do. One of the biggest, Bo Burlingham, you may have had Bo on the show. Bo wrote a great book called Finish Big. If you haven't read it, it's a great book. He talks about the depression that a lot of business owners go through after they sell their company. It's a real thing. It's definitely a real thing. You think, how can someone that's just been, given a check for millions of dollars feel depressed? Well, it's much more common than you think it would be. Bo documents in his book a lot of examples where business owners were deriving so much of their self-worth, so much of their social connections, so much of their, how they think about the world was as a founder, a CEO. They got respect from being that person. And so the money is in the bank, but they've lost that personal that ego.
You want to know what's funny, John? Is Neil did a whole stand-up comedy show about that. After he sold his business.
you're kidding.
No, I sold my business 20 years ago, and one of the stories I tell, which is, really true, is I used to go to cocktail parties in New York, and people would talk to me. And one time I went to a party right after I sold my company, and they said, "What do you do?" I said, "I'm retired." And, people looked over my shoulder and said, "Oh, we'll be right back. Excuse me." I became a non-entity. And so, I noticed in Santa Barbara, too, which is a haven for retired people, that they either love it or they hate it, because it used to be when they were working, they were who they were in business. And here, everyone's sort of the same. We're all unemployed. So it's sometimes tough for people's egos to be in a flat playing field and not the CEO. And it's not for everybody.
It certainly isn't. And so, I think it makes sense to find something that you want to go do before you sell your company that you're equally, if not more, excited about going to do. I mean, I sold my last company back in 2008, 2009. We have a young family, but it was a younger family at the time. And my wife and I decided that we wanted to go live in another country. And so we were really excited about that opportunity. We were excited about the planning, the move, the exploration, the discovery, and it really gave me something to really sink my teeth into, and so that was fun for us. Other people, they want to start a not-for-profit, they want to start another business in many cases. Most entrepreneurs who are hard-driving, success-oriented people are not going to be happy on the golf course, right? So having something that they're equally excited about going to do, I think, is probably a first step before you sell to ensure a relatively smooth transition.
Right. I often say to people, we all need purpose. And so when people retire too young without purpose, it leaves them depressed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, I think in business, we go through these stages, right, where purpose is survival in the beginning, right? It's a very visceral, like, I need to make payroll. And then if business succeeds and the company grows, oftentimes we become our worst enemies in that company because, we sometimes self-sabotage, right? Like, we actually create problems for ourselves, maybe not intentionally, but subconsciously we're out trying to create a little bit of sandpaper in the business so that there's a problem for me to go solve. And we see that all the time where entrepreneurs – actually become the thing that's holding their company back, because they've got the brakes on. They're not maybe necessarily growing as quickly as the business could grow. They're in the business because they just like that ego gratification of being the boss. But the company would actually be better served with someone else running it, and that's a point where I think the owner really needs to look hard in the mirror and say, okay, I got to go do something else that I'm excited about, because I'm now holding my company back.
So John, your trip from Canada to America, you actually speak English very well. So the transition must have gone well.
We actually didn't move to America. We moved to France. So si vous parlez, on peut parler en français si vous voulez, mais maybe not.
the only thing I can say in French is soixante-six. That was my room number. You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
Most of my family, they never graduated high school or even let alone go to college, so I'm trying to break that barrier.
My daughter Brooklyn was also a motivation for me to go back to school.
Every day after work, went straight to school, studied hard, and it paid off.
At age 26, Kareem finished his high school diploma.
I could not have done it alone.
I feel like if I didn't have anyone to push me, I wouldn't even bother to do it. I got one milestone down the drain, and now I got to work on the next. I see the future is really bright for me. I feel like it doesn't matter the age, as long as you go back and get it done. The high school diploma is just added to the confidence, and now I feel unstoppable.
No one gets a diploma alone. You have more support than you realize. If you're thinking of finishing your high school diploma, you have help. Find free adult education classes near you at finishyourdiploma.org. That's finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by the Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Come play at Ealing's Park, whether it's by yourself, as a team, with your dog, on your bike, or soaring through the sky. Come play anytime, any day. For over 25 years, the Ealing's Park Foundation has been dedicated to maintaining this beautiful open space and creating a place for the entire community to come play. Ealing's Park is a remarkable environmental example of what is possible when people care about the best parts of their community and take ownership of wonderful facilities like our park. Ealing's Park receives no financial support from any aspect of government and is completely self-supporting. So come visit the park today and support Santa Barbara's largest nonprofit park. Join the many Santa Barbarans saying, Ealing's is my park, and make it your park too. For information, call 569-5611. That's 569-5611. Or visit online at www.ealingspark.org. That's ELINGSPARK.org.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1937, located on the corner of Olive and Cota Street in downtown Santa Barbara.
And John, so jumping right back in, what you talk a lot about building a more valuable company. And so even if you're not planning on selling it, so how do you go about doing that? And what's why should you start thinking like you want to sell it before you actually want to?
Well, I think you make different decisions if you're thinking of selling and building value than if you would if you're thinking about just building revenue. You know, from an early age, we get socialized to believe that as business owners, our profit and loss statement is our report card at the end of the year, right? So if you pick up a cover of Inc. magazine, they celebrate top-line revenue. The Inc. 5000 is the 5,000 fastest-growing companies in the United States. It's all about top-line revenue growth. And unfortunately, I think if you look at it and try to unpack that, you realize that revenue oftentimes comes at the expense of value. And so I'm a big believer in instead of focusing on just top-line revenue for revenue's sake, focus on value. Let me give you an example. So one thing you could do if you wanted to grow your revenue really, really quickly is you could cross-sell all your existing customers lots of other services and products. And what that would do is increase your revenue, but it would also likely decrease your attractiveness to a buyer, because what a buyer buys, they're making a fundamental decision. They're making a decision if they want to buy you or basically compete with you and recreate what you've created. If you've got a bunch of me-too products that you've cross-sold your customers to, they're going to look at that company and say, there's no differentiation. You don't have what Warren Buffett calls a competitive moat, right? You're not really differentiated on all those products you've cross-sold those few customers. In fact, because you've cross-sold a bunch of customers, you've got customer concentration issues. Now you've just got a handful of customers where you should, you know, you've got too much dependency on one or two customers. And so they're going to look at your business and say, in fact, I'm not going to buy it, I'm just going to compete with it. Yet, by contrast, if you've got one thing that you do better than anybody else in the world, if you are the absolute market leader in doing one thing, then an acquirer is going to look at that business and say, you know what, trying to compete with this person is really tough. Let's just go out and buy her. Or let's go out and buy that company, or let's buy that business that he's running today. That's where you've got premium multiples, but that takes enormous discipline, because again, society says grow your top line revenue. That's your report card, right? Or your profitability's report card. But I think a more nuanced approach to running a company is looking at the value of your business, because ultimately, you know, the biggest asset of most business owners is not their home, right? It's not their 401k plan. It's their business.
Okay. So let me ask you this question.
Sure.
You left out one factor, and that is if I own 100% of a company, and let's take the example you've been using, $1 million, and let's assume that the company has $100,000 of net income. It may result in that $100,000 of $200,000 of salary that goes to you. You now sell the company. You get $1 million. After capital gains, you get $700,000. You put that money to work at 1% in a money market account, and all of a sudden, you're substantially less off in terms of personal cash flow. So how much of your program takes into account the trade-off between your income you're getting and the value in terms of income of the capital gain you're going to get, and how do you replace your salary?
Well, first of all, most of our users would do much better than two or three times SDE. Brokers call SDE seller's discretionary earnings, but it refers to basically how much economic value you're deriving from your business. So in your example of a business generating $1 million in revenue, $100,000 in profit, but $200,000 in salary for the owner, the SDE in that case would be $300,000 roughly, basically the $100,000 plus the $200,000. And a typical very small company with about $1 million in sales would garner offers of two or three times SDE. In our case, we're looking for much better multiples so that you're getting enough basically money to live on for the rest of your life. But it's a very good point. Doesn't always happen, and obviously we don't work with all business owners out there, and so you do have to make that trade-off of how you're going to create that income. Part of it is making sure your business is worth more than two or three times SDE. The other part of it, though, is remember that there is a hidden sort of cost associated with running your company, and that is the mental strain it takes. A lot of business owners say, why would I sell for three or four times earnings when I could just run it for the next 10 years and get 100% of those earnings for the next 10 years? The problem with that is that running a company, even if it's set up to run without you, is enormously taxing. I remember I got a chance to interview and spend some time with Tim Ferriss, you know, the guy who wrote the 4-Hour Workweek and all the subsequent books and all the tremendous success he's had. And I said, you know, you'd set this company up to run without you, and admittedly, in the book, you know, you say you could run it with 4 hours a week of your time. Why would you ever sell that? I mean, that's incredible. Why would you ever sell it? And he explained it to me like this. He said, John, even though it took me only 4 hours to run, it was like my CPU in my brain, i.e. the processing unit of my brain, was always running virus protection software. It was taking so much of my mental energy, even though I wasn't doing anything in the business, I was always churning in the background. And when I talk to entrepreneurs, I hear that resonates with them. They realize that even then, when they're not in their company, when they're having a barbecue with their family or they're out, you know, doing whatever, it's still in the background. They never, never fully leave. And that can be exhausting mentally. And so I think there's an untold upside in selling your company, which is not only the money you garner from it, which you rightly point out may be modest in some certain circumstances, but there's a huge upside to the freedom, the mental break you get from really walking away.
Of course, not to be put on my other hat as a therapist, but a lot of people that, and I agree with you, a lot of people are in that position. It doesn't matter how many hours they work. It has to do with their need to be recycling all the negatives that could happen. Is that happens when they're retired and they're worried about whether or not the delivery guy is going to come on time or whether they walk the dog enough, that sort of personality.
Or you having radio shows.
Or exactly. So, I mean, sometimes you really have to take a look at yourself and see if you're going to, is there an escape from your own neurotic behavior?
It's a great point. It's a great point. You know, entrepreneurs, if they're one thing, they tend to be control freaks, right? Like if you talk to a dozen business owners, what you'll hear is a very common theme threading throughout, which is oftentimes the need for control, right? It's what got them into business for themselves in the first place, right? Like the one common theme is they chose not to go work for General Motors. They chose not to go work for Apple. Right? They've chosen a life less ordinary. And part of the reason for that is they just bristle under authority and they can't really get over the fact that they just want control. They need to control their time, who they work with, what they do. And so you're right. If you can't channel that in a positive way, it's a problem.
And also, I guess there are many companies, and I would hope that, I mean, I don't hope, I would think that that almost all of the purchasers would want you to stick around for a while. So now you're putting the entrepreneur in a position where not only aren't they the boss, but they have to stick around during the transition.
Yeah, I mean, that's the worst possible scenario. And again, we try to do everything we can for our guys, our customers, that they have a minimum length of earnout. But it happens, in especially in service businesses. An earnout is where you've got a portion of your proceeds from the sale, which are at risk and tied to a future target that you've got to hit, as you rightly point out, as an employee of your acquirer. And that's like the worst scenario for an entrepreneur. Not only do they need control, they want freedom. It's kind of what wires them, what drives them is that desire for freedom. Not only that, but now they can't control their outcome because they're reporting to some district manager, reports to some regional vice president, reports to some, you know, country manager, and you're no longer in charge. It's the worst case scenario. So again, what we try to do with our customers is try to get them to the point where they don't need an earnout, or the earnout component of their deal is so minimal that they can walk away if life ever gets arduous under those conditions.
So it's like getting a divorce and living with your wife or your husband for an extra 6 months.
or 3 years, which is the average length of an earnout in the United States.
Exactly. You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back with our final segment.
For prospective homebuyers, one of the most important steps of the loan process is getting clear and honest information from someone who will speak plainly and truthfully about loan programs and options.
I'm Kelly Marsh, Vice President, California, of Cornerstone Home Lending, where our highly skilled and experienced team takes great pride in helping clients obtain home financing with honest, knowledgeable, fast, friendly, and efficient service. As a Santa Barbara native who has spent the past 20 years in the mortgage industry and has closed over 4,000 loans, I'd appreciate the opportunity to earn your business and invite you to visit thekellymarshteam.com or call my office at 805-563-1100 to learn more about how Cornerstone Home Lending can help you determine the best way to manage mortgage debt to achieve a more stable financial future.
Licensed by the Department of Business Oversight under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. California Residential Mortgage Lending Act license number 41DB072220. California Financial Lending Law license number 60DB072528. Loan originator NMLS number 245822. Not a commitment to loan. Equal housing opportunity.
Hi, I'm Diane Duva with an invitation for you to enjoy a great dining experience at my favorite restaurant, the world-famous Arnaldi's Cafe, one of Santa Barbara's oldest and most intimate restaurants since 1940. It's located on the corner of Olive and Cota Streets in downtown Santa Barbara. Arnaldi's specializes in traditional home-style Italian food prepared with the freshest produce, finest quality meats and fish, and the very best imported Italian meats, cheeses, and olive oil, along with local fish and specials from our Santa Barbara Farmers Market, and an extensive wine list served in the unique atmosphere of a candlelit dining room. Arnaldi's also caters to weddings and rehearsal dinners, receptions, graduations, birthdays, holiday parties, or any special event, with two large dining rooms, a huge heated patio, fire pit, two bocce ball courts, and a stone barbecue with red oak wood. And Arnaldi's is happy to work with you to create a custom menu and handle any special requests. Visit arnaldis.com or call 805-962-5394.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
And we're speaking with John Warolo, who has a best-selling book, Built to Sell, Creating a Business That Can Thrive Without You. So if you're interested in more of what John has to say, his book is available, John, I'm assuming, on Amazon.
Oh, yeah.
And so, John, you know, wondering, what can business owners do to attract sellers? Should they be the ones reaching out? Should they, if they are ready to sell, should they be actively trying to find a buyer? Or what type of buyer is the best buyer? Help us understand that a little better.
One of the simple tactics you can use is attend your industry trade show. So most industries will have an annual shindig where it usually in Vegas or Orlando or whatever, and that's where all of the industry players go. And my recommendation is if you haven't been going to the industry event, go to the industry event, because not only will you meet all the other colleagues and peers that you're in your industry, you likely also meet the buyers that are looking to buy companies in your industry. So the private equity groups will go. A lot of the large strategic acquirers will be there. And one of the reasons they go is to meet potential acquisition candidates. So that's a very tactical thing, but it's a simple thing you can do to make sure you're sort of on the radar of potential buyers.
And so you speak about in your book a little bit about why it's better to have a strategic buyer as opposed to a financial buyer. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, sure can. So two types of buyers. Financial buyers essentially buying your future stream of profit. And so they're saying, okay, this company is going to make $100,000 next year, and we're willing to spend X amount of dollars today for the rights to that money in the future. Oftentimes it's wealthy individuals, family offices, can be private equity groups, but they're going to basically give you the lowest offer because they've got no strategic value in buying your business. They're simply buying your future stream of profits. A strategic buyer will have some assets that they bring to bear that makes your company much more valuable in their hands. So Microsoft recently, last year, bought LinkedIn. I can't remember what they paid. I think it was $19 billion or $26 billion. I mean, it's a ridiculous, outlandish valuation, completely off the charts on any sort of economic model. Why would they do that? Well, Microsoft figures one of the big challenges is getting people to upgrade, to go from older versions of Office and all the other software that they use and move to Office 365 in the cloud. They've got to come up with a compelling value proposition for you to do that. And one of the ideas they had is, what if we embed LinkedIn data into Office products so that when you open up Office and you look at Outlook and you look at a meeting coming up, instead of it just saying, hey, I've got a meeting with Diane O'Neill next Tuesday at 2, it actually says, and it shows you Diane's LinkedIn profile so you can see where she works and where Neil's company was that he sold 10 years ago, whatever. That LinkedIn information is now embedded in Office, and it makes Office a very much more compelling value proposition. There are a billion machines running Office, old versions of Office, and Microsoft in Seattle would have said, if we could convert 10% of a billion machines to go to 365, well, that's 100 million machines, 100 million computers, well, that's worth spending whatever it was, $26 billion to buy LinkedIn. And that's the kind of calculus that a strategic buyer is making. They're saying, in our hands, this company is worth way more than it is in the hands of the current owners. And it's because they've got some strategic assets to leverage. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. So in other words, they want you more for just your cash flow. They want you to be able to leverage it into their business. And that is the best marriage, really.
Well, John, thank you so much. If I had a business to sell, I'd be calling you. But the only thing I do now besides this is walk my dogs, and I don't think it's that valuable to Microsoft or anybody else. Anyway, thank you so much. Thank you for listening, everyone. You've been listening to Money Talk, and we'll be back next week.